We have heard more times than we likely care to that we are a vulnerable population during this COVID pandemic, and even more so if we have any pre-existing condition that makes one more susceptible to the virus. Therefore, we as a population need to take certain precautions to reduce our chance of becoming infected. That means being proactive. That will not change as we continue to endure the ongoing threat. But what about once the imminent threat is past? Two recent articles shed light on what some of the long-term effects, good and not so good, of this historic epidemic might be. Next Avenue's May 8, 2020 article by Richard Eisenberg, "Will COVID-19 Make the Decline Narrative of Aging Worse?" describes an ageist war between the "they are weak and expendable" side and the "they are remarkable, wise, and willing to work for social good" side. And AARP's May 4, 2020 article by Andy Markowitz, "10 Things the Pandemic Has Changed for Good," offers interesting insights into telehealth, travel, wearing face masks, and more. And I'll be beginning with, "Will COVID-19 make the decline narrative of aging worse?" First, there was OK Boomer, the pejorative meme mocking older people. Then came hashtag Boomer Remover, the morbid catchphrase used by some millennials and Gen Zers as a shorthand for the coronavirus pandemic to describe the higher vulnerability of boomers generally to COVID-19. Now there is hashtag Grandma Killer. That delightful hashtag comes from the recent flurry of tweets by conservative commentator Bethany Mandel, 34, including these. "Remember when we were told we had to flatten the curve and we'd lock down for a few weeks to ramp up PPE and free up ventilators or else we'd have to start death panels? When did that turn into indefinite lockdowns and economic destruction? Because if it saves one life, you can call me Grandma Killer. I'm not sacrificing my home, food on the table, all of our docs and dentists, every form of pleasure, museums, zoos, restaurants, and all my kids' teachers in order to make other people comfortable. The decline narrative of aging. It's the notion that getting older means decline, deterioration, decay, and dependency. They were around before the pandemic, of course. But outbursts in social media and on cable TV, as well as COVID-19 healthcare guidelines from government officials, medical professionals, and ethicists have made these views more public and, if you will, more virulent. Gerontologist and Agescapes blogger Martin Hyde, who blogs at Agescapes, calls the boomer bashing gerontocidal language. In a recent Los Angeles Times story about how the pandemic was amplifying ageism, referred schoolteacher Bonnie Reed. She said, "Am I the only one feeling like they're ready to throw us out?" Probably not. The irony is, as the 100-Year Life co-author Andrew Scott notes, this is the first pandemic to occur since the global population consisted of more people over age 65 than under 5. In her excellent recent episode of The Big Middle podcast, Ageism and the Virus, Susan Florey chatted with age studies authority Margaret Morgan Roth Goulet about how the pandemic has added to the decline narrative of aging. They concluded that COVID-19 has led some people to think that all older people are the same and all are now dangerous to the citizenry. A lot of people still think you're 70, therefore you have one of those dehumanizing underlying health conditions. So obviously you're on your way out, Florey said. The overwhelming embedded stereotype is that over 70, over 75, and you're on that spiral of decline. And, she added, even the doctors have swallowed that bias. Scott said he has seen a conflation of being old with having health problems. Gillette, known for turning words into daggers, described the recent healthcare guidelines for rationing ICU beds and ventilators due to a person's age as like eruptions of pus in the body politic because they are so ageist. The first example, such as rationing, came during Italy's coronavirus lockdown. Then, some U.S. governors, such as in California, Colorado, Massachusetts, and Minnesota, some universities and state commissions followed. Guidelines from the University of Pittsburgh, Goulet said, deemed them the life cycle principle. Younger patients would get priority based on these age group breakdowns, 12 to 40, 41 to 60, 61 to 75, and 75 plus. Goulet's term for them, culling the old. What did COVID-19 numbers say? It's true, as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has said, that 80% of people who have died from COVID-19 are 65 and older. And as the United Nations policy brief, The Impact of COVID-19 on Older Persons, noted, fatality rates for those over 80 years of age is 5 times the global average. But equally true and more important is that the CDC has said people with the highest risk are the older adults with serious underlying medical conditions like diabetes, lung cancer, or heart disease. Not all people 65 plus have those, which is the problem with the decline narrative of aging. What's been most troubling has been the strength of the us versus them narrative that we are seeing and how that appears to be growing, said Maura O'Neill, Vice President of Research Interpretation at the Frameworks Institute, a social change endeavor designed to improve the public's understanding of aging. It's so bold-faced, so out in the open. They've lived their lives. If they have to die, they have to die. Being treated as the other. Becca Levy, a Yale School of Public Health professor and a Next Avenue influencer in aging, said, "I think the pandemic has led to a lot of language that homogenizes older people and also treats them as if they are the other, the group that should be walled off." O'Neill believes the stress that is likely bringing on to older people is very detrimental. Levy's groundbreaking work has found that when older people assimilate negative age stereotypes, they have a shorter life expectancy than those who don't, 7.5 years shorter on average. Levy and 7 researchers around the world just published the paper Aging in Times of the COVID-19 Pandemic, Avoiding Ageism and Fostering Intergenerational Solidarity. Their conclusion? What we are seeing in public discourse is an increasing portrayal of those over the age of 70 as being all alike with regard to being helpless, frail, and unable to contribute to society. These views are being spread by social media, the press, the public announcements by government officials throughout the world. They also wrote that they feared chronological age will become an accepted criterion in the very near future for triage decisions, what they call the most blatant expression of ageism. The UN reports stern warning. It is most important for triage protocols to ensure that medical decisions are based on medical need, ethical criteria, and the best available scientific evidence. The future of the decline narrative. So, what can we expect to happen to the decline narrative of aging when the coronavirus outbreak lessens and our attention turns more toward economic concerns than health ones? The decline story will be given added momentum, predicts Scott. And analysts who study older workers and employment are especially fearful. Research in the wake of the last recession clearly suggested that older people, as a result of ageist norms, had a more difficult time getting reemployed, said Paul Irving, chairman of the Milken Institute Center for the Future of Aging. Prospects for higher rates of unemployment are fairly high. History has shown that older adults have greater challenges in that environment. In an interview with Next Avenue reporter Andrea Cooper, Urban Institute Program on Retirement Policy Director Richard Johnson agreed. The possibility that an older hire will contract the virus, develop complications, miss a lot of work, and rack up expensive health care bills that are partly paid by the employer's health insurance will likely make employers even more reluctant to hire older workers, he said. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Interpublic Collection of ad agencies is exploring a system of classifying its U.S. employees in one of these three levels. Its workers, whose coronavirus antibody tests show that they had had the infection, would be level one and could come back to work first. Ones without antibodies but considered low to moderate risk would be level two and come back second. They'd include workers under 65 who don't live with a high-risk people and who don't have a chronic disease such as diabetes or hypertension. Employees over 65 or those who are pregnant, smoke, have chronic diseases or health issues would be level three. They would need to wait the longest to return to work. Jacqueline James, co-director of the Center on Aging and Work at Boston College, told Cooper that employers have a legitimate public health interest in trying to make sure they don't bring people into the workplace who will infect others with COVID. And, voicing a note of optimism, James said it's also possible that people who have been exposed or who have had the illness and have recovered from it and have the antibodies may be more likely to be hired. It would be lovely to think so. The story we're not hearing. It would also be heartening if more employers, policymakers, and other Americans saw the abilities and strengths that make many older people offer. I'm 78. I don't feel like I've reached my intellectual peak yet, Goulet said on the Big Middle podcast. As Irving told me, we know that aging is a principal risk factor for both chronic and infectious disease. But there is also another story. We have learned that older adults are a critically valuable resource, exemplified by the retired New York health professionals who return to work to offer experience, empathy, and assistance to younger colleagues in the fight against the virus. Terry Kelber, an Encore Public Voices fellow, noted, "In New York City, my organization, United Neighborhood Houses of New York, a policy and social change organization, older people have been mobilized to address issues such as food insecurity, poor conditions in public housing, and helping youth in under-resourced communities succeed." And, he added, "Obviously, it is time that we older people are seen as the resource we are." Levy pointed to a new study from a team of researchers in Spain showing that older people have actually been less lonely and less depressed in quarantine than younger people. "That was really interesting," she said. "Research suggests that at least some older persons have developed resilience and coping skills that have helped them in this time." O'Neill of the Frameworks Institute said she didn't think older adults were getting their due for what they've been doing in the pandemic. Grandparents are taking a lot of the homeschooling responsibilities for parents who are working, she said. Which side will win? Describing ageism on her podcast episode with Goulet, Flory said, "It's always been a war, and it will continue to be a war. But the question is, which side will win? The they are weak and expendable side, or the they are remarkable storytellers, and many of them are interesting and wise and willing to work for social good? That side." O'Neill thinks it's possible the decline narrative will diminish as the pandemic fades. It doesn't have to worsen. We are not powerless in the inevitability of that happening, she said. Irving believes there's another narrative we're spreading. Of course, children and young people are priorities. They are our future. But every life has dignity, and the moral test of any society is how it treats its most vulnerable members, including those who are old. Going on now to 10 things the pandemic has changed for good. The effects of the lockdowns, layoffs, and massive public measures to contain COVID-19 will last long after any threat from the virus is gone, contends Jeremy Cole, who directs the Center for the Digital Future at USC's Annenberg School of Communications. In the future, we'll talk about BC, before Corona, and after. In collaboration with the Interactive Advertising Bureau, a membership group of media, marketing, and tech companies, the center last month launched the Coronavirus Disruption Project, surveying a representative sample of 1,000 Americans about how they are living and coping with the rapid changes wrought by the pandemic. The results suggest that many of the ways we are adapting to life with the coronavirus, some digital, some physical, will reverberate long after a vaccine or treatment returns life to, quote, normal, unquote. There are 10 areas where the outbreak is likely to have permanent effects on our personal, professional, and cultural lives, drawn from the survey findings and experts' analysis. Working from home. I think there will be some upside to this disruption that workers will want to preserve, said Deborah DiGincenzo, a president of VirtualWorks, a consulting firm that advises companies on transitioning to telework. People, families are going to be spending more time together, she says. I think people will be more adamant that they want more time to work at home and not go back to all of the crazy commuting they were doing before. For many, that will sit well with their bosses. Nearly three-quarters of the corporate finance officials surveyed in late March by Gartner, a business research and consulting firm, said their companies plan to move at least 5% of on-site workers to permanent remote status as part of their post-COVID cost-cutting efforts. Seeing your doctor. A survey last year by the University of Michigan's National Poll on Healthy Aging, which is co-sponsored by AARP, found that only 4% of people over 50 had seen a doctor virtually in the previous year. More than half did not know whether their doctor even offered video visits. Patients and practitioners alike were interested in telemedicine, said Preeti Malani, an infectious disease specialist at the university and the poll's director, but in no great rush. That has changed at the speed of light, she said. Doctors and patients who previously might have considered telehealth only a limited circumstances, such as an illness while traveling or a routine post-op chat, are now seeing that a wider range of services can be provided virtually. Along with cutting out hassles like parking and waiting room time, video visits make it easier for family members to observe and participate, a big boon for caregivers. How about shopping for groceries? It's no surprise that the online purchase and home delivery of groceries has surged amid coronavirus lockdowns. A March 2020 survey of more than 1,500 consumers by investment firm RBC Capital Markets found that 55% had shopped for groceries online, compared with 36% in a similar poll in late 2018. The number doing so weekly nearly doubled, and downloads of apps for delivery services like Instacart, Walmart Grocery, and Peapod doubled, tripled, even quadrupled in just a month. RBC, which has taken consumers' pulse on online grocery shopping regularly since 2015, dug deeper into whether the changes might be lasting. More than half of those who purchased groceries online said the COVID crisis made them more likely to keep doing so permanently. Staying in touch. Zoom happy hours, Facebook live watch parties, virtual visits with loved ones. One key finding of the Coronavirus Disruption Project is that while the pandemic has moved our social lives online, people report that their relationships with relatives, friends, and co-workers have not suffered. That doesn't mean that we won't go back to getting drinks with friends, although going to bars ranked last among 15 things the Center for Digital Future asked people if they miss. But the whole notion of how we interact, socializing, has really been affected in a pretty profound way, Cole said, especially for the many older Americans newly adopting video tools to stay in touch. Zoom and video conferencing, although we make fun of it, it's not enjoyable to be in hour after hour. I think it does make people feel connected, he said. Plain phone calls now feel sort of shallow. We're getting used to seeing people. Wearing face masks. Wearing masks to stem contagion has long been commonplace in many Asian countries and some Asian American communities. This kind of event that will lead to a sea change in mask wearing that Robert Kahn, a law professor at the University of St. Thomas at St. Paul, Minnesota, he has studied American attitudes and stigmas about public face covering. While it's never going to be a majority phenomenon, he predicts the practice will become routine in some settings and situations. In dense urban areas, for example, or when people with a cold or common flu need to venture out. Masks are not personal protective devices. They're social protective devices, Kahn said. Everybody knows someone who is immunocompromised or has some of the COVID risk factors. And I think that leads to a sense of when you go outside, you might want to wear a mask, at least for enough of the population that when you're making the decision, you won't feel like a weirdo. Going to the movies, the theatrical movie business was already in decades-long decline, Cole says, accelerated in recent years by the rise of streaming giants like Netflix and Amazon Prime, and ever shorter windows before big releases move to smaller screens. Post-pandemic, he forecasts, movies will be one of the slowest things to return, and cinemas will close in droves. Traveling by air. Fares, route options, airline choice, and other aspects of flying may fluctuate wildly as the industry adjusts to whatever new normal follows the pandemic, experts say. But travelers can reliably expect a different experience in the airport and on airplanes for years to come. We're going to see cleanliness matter more, said Gary Leff, author of the influential air travel blog View from the Wing. During challenging economic climates, airlines have been known to go 18 months without deep cleaning planes to save money. Now, no matter how tough things are, airlines will need to convince customers that these tight spaces on metal tubes are safe places to be. Airports will have to up their hygiene game, too, more frequently sanitizing public spaces and making room for people to maintain distancing in lines. Masks, which several U.S. airlines are now requiring for crews and passengers, will remain common in cabins, Leff said. And it will be hard for airport security to roll back their willingness to allow larger hand sanitizer bottles through the checkpoint. Riding public transportation. The pandemic has put public transit systems in the unenviable position of urging people not to use them unless absolutely necessary. Coming back from that will be difficult and will involve changes in how transit agencies operate, especially when it comes to convincing people to return to the close quarters of buses and subway cars, said David Zipper, a visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Taubman Center for State and Local Government. There's lots of technologies that are already being developed now to enhance safety, including steps like using UV light, reconfiguring buses to provide more space between passengers, looking at doing temperature checks for people boarding, he said. Many riders could appreciate knowing that the person standing or sitting next to them has been screened. Many systems have slashed service as ridership plunged. The worst thing that could happen, Zipper says, is for them to make those reductions permanent, as budget-strapped transit agencies did during the Great Recession. Once you do that, the riders, they change their plans, he said, and they really don't come back. Then there's protecting your privacy. In the absence of a vaccine, contact tracing, the ability to track whom an infected person has encountered and possibly exposed using smartphone apps and Bluetooth technology, figures prominently in the strategies to contain the virus while easing social distancing. It is considered so important that arch rivals Apple and Google are working together to quickly develop and distribute contact tracing tools. The tech behemoths say that their technology will protect the personal information users must share to make contact tracing work, like their health histories and the identities of people they've come in contact with. Cole is skeptical. There's no way that we can come out of this without loss of privacy, he asserts. And, he adds, most of us probably won't mind. Health triumphs everything, he says. If we really do contact tracing, it means we're going to have to let someone, the government, Google, know where we are, report who we're next to. We just don't seem to care that much when it's our health and our family's health at stake. Washing your hands. Thanks to the coronavirus, we all now know how to properly wash our hands and how long it takes to sing Happy Birthday twice. And we won't soon forget, judging by the new data from Bradley Corporation, a maker of fixtures and accessories for commercial washrooms, that annually surveys Americans on their hand-washing habits. Bradley's latest poll, conducted in early April to measure the coronavirus effect on hand hygiene, confirms that we are all washing our hands more often and longer. 78% of respondents reported lathering up at least 6 times a day, more than double the pre-pandemic rate, and 77% followed the 20-second rule. Previously, most people washed for 5 to 15 seconds, and 88% say they're likely to maintain the habit. Well, it's encouraging to know that some in the field, like Mara O'Neill, believe it is possible that the decline narrative will diminish as the pandemic fades, and that many of the positive things that have occurred during the pandemic, like using telehealth and hand washing, will continue. I am glad to announce that I have done my grocery shopping online, and I have also participated in telehealth. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Squeak.